like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animal, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and my guest is Erica Abrams, co-founder and president of Animal Aid Unlimited, a rescue operation, hospital, and sanctuary in Udaipur, India. Many years ago, Abrams, her husband Jim, and daughter Claire, who hail from Seattle, began traveling to India, then started spending part of each year there, living in Udaipur. During those stints, the Abrams were struck by the large number of injured and ill animals on the street, and that there was no vet hospital or other care available for them. They saw a need. They eventually decided to move there and fill that need. We'll hear about how and why Seattleites began visiting India, more of the specifics of what prompted the move, and founding Animal Aid Unlimited in 2002, how the organization has evolved since then, and more when I speak with Erica Abrams in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Also later in the show, I'll speak with Don Goldstein, our Greyhound correspondent, for an update on the process by which Prop 67, the proposed constitutional amendment that, if passed, would end Greyhound racing in Florida over the next 3 years, is advancing. We're in a critical phase, in fact, when you could still express your support to the commissioners for this amendment. More later on how to do exactly that. A quick programming note, I'll be away next week, and I'm thrilled to report that in my absence, Bev Capshaw and Ronnie Elliott will be holding forth. As you probably know, they do a great job. It's a fun, great show, so be sure not to miss that. Right now, let's get to Erica in India with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing DJ at WMNF.org, or texting 813-433-0885 via Skype. This is Erica Abrams on Talking Animals. Good morning, Erica.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
I'm very well, and thanks to DT for our technological help. We are Skyping with you, indeed, from India. So we have all kinds of ground to cover about Animal Aid Unlimited, and we'll certainly delve into both its present and its past in a moment. But first, can you talk about what initially prompted the travel to India? I mean, sort of set the scene. You're all living in Seattle, as I understand it, and I guess one of you comes up with the idea to visit India. Whose idea was that back in the day?
It was my husband's idea to visit India because he had come as a young man. He is 77 now, but when he was 19, he came to India for the first time. And he always, we met much later, and when I was 30, and I really had traveled very little out of Seattle. And in 1986, he said, let's go. And I dreaded it. And I thought, oh my God, it's going to be poor people and it's going to be dirty and I'm not going to like it. I'll be scared. And within about 10 minutes of arriving in Mumbai, my world was transformed and I was so happy to be there. It was exotic, interesting, smiles from everybody in 360 degrees of smiles. And then a huge appeal was the presence of animals on the street. And at the time, I was very naive about what that meant for the animals. I was only just romantically enjoying seeing cows and pigs and goats just wandering on the street.
Well, of course, we'll hear more about the animals in a moment. But on that first trip where your husband suggested this, was it really kind of fundamentally, hey, this is a trip just to sort of broaden our horizons the way a lot of people might travel?
It was just classic tourism. And the appeal that India held for me had nothing to do, at least overtly, with any kind of spiritual quest or any of the or any intellectual interest. I was charmed by the clothes, the costumes, the jewelry. I loved Hindi. I loved the sound of it. So it was a lot of, in certain ways, superficial things that made it appeal to me so much. But yes, the excursion was really a horizon broadening kind of thing.
Yeah. And then over the course of ensuing trips, in what ways did the reasons and especially your and your family's reactions to those trips change?
I think there was also a practical aspect to it, and that was that I love bargains. I love cheap stuff, and India was so much more affordable than life in Seattle. And so gradually our imagination started to also be provoked by the financial sense it might make for us to do something very experimental and imaginative. So I think that our subsequent trips really started in the early 1990s. And at the time, our daughter was very young. She was born in 1989. So she was like 3 and 4 when we first started to bring her to India. And we would just stay for a few weeks and then a couple of months. And as the years passed, she hated traveling. And so she had some little friends here in Udaipur. And so just on that note, it seemed like, why don't we just go deep instead of broad and get to know this almost random community better than we otherwise would. And maybe I would understand India more deeply by staying put rather than traveling.
Yeah, like you say, it's rather than travel more broadly in India or even to other countries, the way that the initial trip would have been to, hey, let's go to Europe, let's go to other parts of the world. It sounds like this was more and more focused and sort of burrowing in and really setting down roots effectively.
Yeah, it was. And I am, you know, a kind of maybe I'm a dullard, but if I go to a restaurant and I like the food the first time, I order it again the second time. I'm not experimental. People often think that we're probably very well traveled. My husband is, but I am not particularly well traveled. And I've lived in a couple of places in my life, and India is it for now. And I really don't travel much.
Well, on the other hand, I think what you've done and the story behind it and what you're doing now, which we'll get into more in a moment, of course, I don't think any parts of that could justify accusations of being a dullard. I think that'd be the last thing someone would probably.
Well, hey, no, yes, that's true.
But so now your daughter says, hey, I don't really want to travel so much. You guys say, okay, well, related to that, we're just going to settle into Udaipur. Am I doing pretty decent on the pronunciation, Udaipur?
You're perfect, Duncan.
Well, thanks
perfect.
All your coaching on email. I think I've finally gotten there, but I'm still nervous about it. But anyways, okay, so you're there. You're saying we're just going to stay put and really get to know this area. So was that when you were more and more struck then by what the situation with the animals was?
Yes, it came quite a bit later. In the late 90s, we actually started to shift here with where we built a couple of rooms on an existing home in a village about 10 minutes, 15 minutes out of Udaipur, and a very traditional and rustic village. And it was fascinating. And we lived there for almost 10 years. And we lived there and then we've shifted and we still live really close. And it was in the process of actually living there and developing relationships with just little dogs that were around on the street. And when they fell ill, that's when I really realized there were no veterinary services for street animals. There were a couple of private vets, but they didn't have very much experience with dogs. And there were more government vets. Most of the vet training is oriented in India toward dairy production, artificial insemination, and animals that are used in farming. Initially when we first started to want to get help for street animals and the light bulb went off that they have nobody, I looked very diligently to find somebody else who was already doing that in Udaipur so that we could support them and maybe help expand whatever they were doing. And we looked and looked and there truly was nobody doing it. So that was the aha moment for us and for me of sort of saying, wow, if we're going to get them help, we actually have to do something ourselves. And that was a monumental declaration because I had never helped animals in any organized way, just only spontaneously, like, you know, the dogs and cats and the occasional fallen bird. And that was the extent of it. So it was huge.
Two things. One is on the screen where I can see you, but there's a shelf behind there, and there was a nice orange cat that, as you were talking about animals,
yes,
that made an appearance.
Almost,
and
I didn't know you could see me, Duncan.
Yeah.
I did not know that. He just dive-bombed my head, didn't
I know.
He?
It was quite an impressive feat. But anyway, so yeah, I was really curious, and that's interesting. So how about either your husband or your daughter? Because it seems like there would have been somewhere along the line some, I don't know, volunteering at an animal rescue or shelter or something as a prelude or some sort of base.
Yes, you're quite right. It wasn't as if we were oblivious to the possibility of other people doing such work, but we not. Jim actually had in 1995, he had visited a spay-neuter non-government charity in Jaipur, and he had told me about that. And he had also met some folks in Kolkata that had a small rescue service. So the idea had been in a very abstract way, and in a way that, I was admiring people from afar without the foggiest notion, and nor did my husband have a foggy notion that it could ultimately be us putting our foot in that water too. We were aware of the concept.
Sure. But what about back in the Seattle days? I mean, what role did animals play in your family? I mean, were there animals in the household, or were you spending some time with animals, even if not in any kind of
loved every animal I ever saw. And I knew that.
Yeah.
Definitely. But it's funny, and I think about it often, Duncan, about what in the heck was I thinking during the decades of my 20s and 30s when I didn't do anything to help them, and yet I would have called myself a passionate animal lover. But my consciousness wasn't raised about farmed animals in any way. I was still eating dairy products. I was vegetarian, but I was using leather. I had a very incomplete understanding of the real situation happening for animals, and I was much more acquainted with dogs, and so it was just it was kind of a very typical I was sensitive to animals, but to a very low, I think. Not a very impressive level.
Well, you've certainly...
it was necessity was the mother of invention in this case.
Yeah, but that's the thing. You guys obviously said, hey, this requires attention. We don't maybe have that much experience in this realm, but we need to do it because somebody needs to do it. Why not us?
Yeah, and something I should add, Duncan, is that both Jim and I had worked as fundraisers for nonprofit charities for many years, different ones, mostly universities and hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So we were aware of the idea of do-gooders, and we were aware of the role that philanthropy plays in the lives of people who are both generous and maybe can't do things themselves. We understood the dynamics of how you fundamentally build an organization, but from my point of view, only as kind of a staffer. I was a writer usually, and I didn't have management experience. I usually had a boss. I almost always had a good boss, mm-hmm. and needed that, and my identity was not as an entrepreneur in any way. And Jim had a greater experience, but none of it applied, and definitely not applied to a small, burgeoning, tiny little idea that's going to grow incrementally. That was new, definitely new for both of us.
Yeah, but it does sound like there was a couple things at least going on. One was just sort of an overall awakening that you experienced by living there and having visited there a number of times, but once you especially used to kind of set down those roots. And the other thing was looking around at those animals, as you said a moment ago, necessity really is the mother of invention. It's like, well, we have this experience and this experience. We have no experience in the animal realm, but we have to do this because somebody has to. And it sounds like you just sort of stepped up.
Yes, that we really did. But there's I think many of the listeners will have experienced this in their own ways, in their own locales. But that when you start, it becomes so much easier when you're fueled by the individual animals. And so it's not in any way is it kind of an abstract, like, oh, I should do this. As soon as they're laying on your kitchen floor needing you, a parenting kind of a thing wells up in you, and you don't feel like your response is altruistic. It's just like you just want to and you have to help.
Yeah.
And so the animals make it so easy once you start. I'm sure your listeners have experienced that. And that the difference in India from Seattle, for example, is we couldn't have afforded to do a fraction of what we were able to afford. Even in the early years, Duncan, we financed it almost all ourselves at $1,000 a month. which was Jim's pension, essentially.
Wow.
And
wow.
So, you know, it was and it was small potatoes compared to today. Maybe we had 30 or 40 animals and four or five staff, but that was enough in India to fund them and to start to save, you know, dozens of animals and you know, to have dental work done on your Chihuahua in Tampa is going to cost $600 or $700, you know. So it was just an unbelievably doable.
Like you say, it has to be incremental. You start something and it's like, okay, well, we're helping these animals, and if it keeps going and we get sort of caught up in it, we can generate a bit more dough, then we'll help this many more animals. And you just kind of keep traveling down that path, pretty much, like you say, almost by inertia once you start.
Yes, I like that you said that, because I think people often, Indians will say, oh, madam, you are so noble. You have done such noble work. And I think then the only time it felt like effort was in pushing the snowball over the cliff the first time. But it did gather its own momentum and of course, showing up every day and trying your hardest is very helpful. But it was, yeah, that initial push that started a process where sometimes I myself feel like a witness to the goodness that's come out of it. Mm. I don't necessarily feel like an agent of it every time. A lot of times I'm a spectator of just like, whoa, look at that. Look what we did. And that we is not me and my family. It's the staff, it's the volunteers, it's the donors, it's the public personalities like you that's helping build this fabulous momentum for animals.
Being witness to that, and I'll come back to a little volunteer-related story I was going to tell you anyway that has to do with people that travel in that area and have opportunities to volunteer at Animal Aid Unlimited. But let me first let people who might just be tuning in know, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you did just tune in, my guest is Erica Abrams, co-founder and president of Animal Aid Unlimited, a rescue operation hospital and sanctuary located in Udaipur, India. If you'd like to ask Erica a question, who is speaking to us, by the way, via Skype from India, or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj@wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Let's take one of our callers now. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Erica Abrams. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, it's you.
Hi.
We may be having some little interference from the Skype thing. I'm not quite sure. Can you hear me okay or no?
Yes.
Caller? Okay,
yes.
Do you have a question or a comment for Erica?
From Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Am I live?
Yes, you are live on the air. Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Erica, it's Janine from Milwaukee.
Hi, I'm sorry. Who is it?
It's Janine from Milwaukee. Sorry,
Janine.
The connection, I think, might be a little shaky. Yeah.
Erica, how are you?
Hi, dear. I'm great. How incredible that you are that you're calling in.
I am. Well, I will tell you something, listeners and Duncan.
Yes.
I am Erica's first cousin and had the opportunity to go over and witness for myself the work that they have done, the community they have gathered, the love and spirit around everything they're doing. I was there a couple years ago, and I will tell you that the people, too, that she has educated and have supported her in this mission, there's a beautiful matchup of individuals that come to help at the facility every day with some of the specific animals that are also struggling with some of the same challenges. I found that absolutely amazing, and I'd love for you to speak to that a little bit, Erica.
Okay, great. Well, thank you, Janine from Wisconsin, and we'll have Erica answer that. But I'm gonna let the call go just because it seems like it's a little bit shaky and echoey for our conversation.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Janine. Okay, Erica, so that was quite a nice opening there. I don't know if you caught all of what she...
I couldn't have dreamed of a better first call. I'm not sure I actually heard. She was talking about the various people that work at the hospital. Is that what she was...
I think it was a little more effusive than that, just talking about her own experience there and how obviously magical and transformative that was for her. But as part of that, witnessing, as you had sort of addressed in a different way, all the efforts and just how people had these great and powerful experiences helping there and helping the animals and being part of what you guys had created. creative.
Yeah, and Duncan, I'd love to comment on this, that many people that are afraid to come to India, and we'd get fewer American volunteers than Europeans and people from the UK, probably just because of the distance. But those who do come are often in points of transition or are particularly open to the world and its wonders. So I think that contributes something. And then to come into an environment where you have happy disabled animals in such abundance, some of them are ill and healing, and some of them are permanently disabled, but it rocks you to your core in some way that I don't think it's easy to anticipate the effect it's going to have on you. And to be welcomed as cheerfully as the amazing gentle staff do makes for just an extraordinarily sweet opportunity to just look at your own life and say, what am I doing? What do I care about? Look at all these people caring about animals. I love them too. I might, you know, a person might leave and do and have many other charity interests, but I think anybody leaves that experience with an inspiration to do more, to be kinder, to be more of service and be readier, because it's like an atmosphere where it's just fun to do that. And the rewards are so obvious right away because the animals are there. I feel much great respect for the people that do animal rights campaigning who are often in offices and on the phone all day long. And I think they have something to envy in us here that are actually people that are in farm sanctuaries and have moment to moment access to animals, because it makes it so easy to just keep charging forth.
Wow. Well, so this maybe I will get to my other little story now, because it does seem to tie into what you're saying and very much triggered by Janine's observation. So as I often do a day or two before an interview, I'll put something on Facebook and other social media about the guest that I'm interviewing. So as soon as I did that the first time on Monday, I hear from this woman who tutors my son and loves to travel internationally, and a while back did a trip to India to visit Udaipur in a group tour. And some members of her group volunteered at Animal Aid Unlimited and reported back that the experience was incredible and life-changing. So it gets just kind of underscores, I think, what we're talking about in Janine's observations, that in addition to all the amazing things you're doing for the animals, that people that get involved in helping with that effort are themselves helped and transformed, I think.
Yeah, and I think some of the best advice that I ever got was from, I'm sure you know Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Utah.
Of course, yeah.
One of their founding trustees told me a long time ago to guard and protect and nurture every volunteer, whether they stay for 2 hours or 2 months, and whether they're able to interact with animals or are only able to socially interact. Maybe they've come with more social motives, and not to diminish their value to animal protection and or to your organization, and to just relax and realize that everybody's contribution, you know, that you're plant sowing seeds and they will blossom in ways you can't you can't anticipate and you may not see directly. And I think that was so wise, and I hope that I followed that, because the very nicest people imaginable come through the gates of Animal Aid Unlimited. And that was not something that I understood would happen initially, but every single person, almost without exception, has this beautiful heart and energy and will to change this epoch of cruelty into a time of kindness for animals. And there's a lot of sadness in people, I think, when they arrive also, because everybody who loves animals that I meet has a huge sorrow that they're carrying around also. And it's a wonderful, safe place to experience that sorrow and let it go and transform it into joy among other people that know that it is extremely challenging, confronting, and sad to care as much as we do about animals. They're in, you know, it's a crisis for them.
Well, with that in mind, let's take a couple of steps back from what's going on these days and the experience that happened in that group. And again, the observations that Janine had, et cetera. So when you were first getting the organization established, what do you recall were the biggest challenges? Were they cultural? Were they legal parameters? Were there other things? What was the toughest thing about getting launched?
It's a great question, Duncan. Well, one of the problems when we actually launched was people didn't have cell phones and they didn't have landlines. So telephones were almost non-existent in our area of Udaipur and really in Udaipur or in Rajasthan. And so it's hard to run a rescue service when people don't know you exist and there are no phones. We didn't initially, we didn't have a good rescue vehicle and our staff weren't very well trained. We ourselves didn't know very much about how to rescue. And our vet that we was a wonderfully nice person that we hired right away, he didn't have very much. He was a fresher out of university and didn't have very much experience. He had a really lovely attitude, but there were not very many colleagues that he could turn to. There were none in Udaipur. So it was such a makeshift operation. Plus, we didn't speak very good Hindi. And so we had to rely on the interpretation of people that weren't particularly involved. And as you might know, interpretation translation is often sketchy anyway. And so all the subtle nuances, if you wanted somebody to help and you wanted to ask in a really polite way, you know, what would get translated as she needs, you know, or something that where you just feel like, no, that's not how I was saying it.
Yeah.
And so there was so many, I mean, it's so many obstacles. And it was just sheer persistence on our part that got through it. And as Claire got a little older, when she was 14, she started doing a lot of leafleting in schools and making presentations. Just as a young kid, she did, I think she, in the year she was 15, I think she went to 50 schools.
Wow.
And we just canvassed and got our address and information out there into people's hands as best we could. And then things really did change when cell phones were introduced. And that was in about 2005. So that was a huge transition for us. Then getting, you know, we went from three calls a week or three, you know, just such a modest, you know, I won't say pathetic because it couldn't have been otherwise, but it just absolutely mushroomed and proved to us how desperate the residents of the community also were to have rescue help for animals. And it's so easy to sort of say, oh, but they, you know, sometimes travelers think that people don't care. But in most areas in India, there are no shelters and no rescue services. And it's so demoralizing because people don't know how to help and they really need a path. And once you provide that for them, we get, you know, 60 calls a day, almost every day for rescue requests. And that's the highest per capita in India. And I know it's not, obviously it's not because Udaipur residents are more compassionate. It's that they can take action. We've made it easy for them.
Tell me then, what are some of the chief issues with animals? So when you get those 60 calls a day, do they fall into specific kind of patterns or are there a predominant sort of issue that services? Or
yes, Duncan, it's car accidents is number one. The street animals are usually not eating good food or they're not having a consistent diet. And so for wandering cows have very sensitive stomachs and they're ingesting a lot of plastic and that exacerbates any other problem that they have. Many of them have 30, 40, 50 kilos of plastic in their stomachs and they do die from it all the time. So if they've been, let's say they've been injured by a car and they've broken a leg, something that in a dog or in a human is really fixable. For the cow, she lies down, she's got all this plastic in her stomach, and right away she starts to get bloated. And because she can't stand yet, maybe she would have been able to stand otherwise gradually, but she's going to die from that plastic. And so that's a huge problem. An enormous problem in India is dairy consumption. There's the largest herd of cows in the world are in India. The largest meat export is out of India. The largest leather export Leather is either the largest or the second largest. And it's all very much related to the dairy industry because you, I'm sure many of your listeners would know this, but a cow has to be pregnant in order to lactate, has to be impregnated annually to lactate all the time. So it's, and every second cow born, every calf is going to be a little bull calf. And there's no farmer can afford to feed an unproductive animal. And now there's very little bulls used in farming. It's mostly mechanized tractors. So it's a tragedy for all those cows and all those calves. So I know that I'm possibly not saying something new, but many people think because of the expression holy cow that India is a country where cows are protected. And although they're revered, it's a spiritual reverence, but it doesn't very predictably manifest itself in taking care of cows or bull calves. They still have this terrible economic burden of having to dispose of those bull calves in order to keep that dairy industry going. And as compassionate, and I think Indians are tremendous, like, and people everywhere are, I think the Indians absolutely love animals and dogs too. But that is that plastic eating the plastic is a daily worry, and then lack of maintaining medical treatment for all the street dogs. Or, I mean, they've never had any medical treatment at all. So if you don't have a spay neuter program, which most places don't have, and even if you don't have a very vigorous one, there's a limited food source. The reason that dogs are there is because there is a food source in the garbage, but it's limited. So if a mama has six puppies, only probably one will survive much after the weaning period. And often the mother gets so malnourished as the puppies are getting weaned that she falls ill also. So that's the puppy mortality is huge and throughout India.
Quite a lot to take in. So let me let folks know again, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. My guest is Erica Abrams, co-founder and president of Animal Aid Unlimited, a rescue operation hospital and sanctuary located in Udaipur, India. We're speaking to her from by way of Skype from India. Erica and her family started Animal Aid Unlimited in 2002 as transplanted Seattle residents. We invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's take another call. Okay. I guess we lost them. All right. So sounds like huge, huge obstacles inherently, culturally, otherwise, just sheer numbers, it sounds like. So give me a sense of Animal Aid Unlimited these days and obviously all the things that you did overcome and learn along the way. What does it look like now?
From the point of view of the hospital and the sanctuary, beautiful and big. We have about 700 animals. We have three vets. One is an Indian surgeon, and then we have a Spanish woman who's a surgeon and a radiologist from Chile who has his own ultrasound machine. So it chugs along wonderfully to take care of sick, ill and injured animals. And I think for our family and for the people close to the organization, including other volunteers that have been with us for a long time that are really part of the management effort, I think there's an increasing interest in the farmed animal problems and the need to spread vegetarian and vegan values everywhere we go to try to save more animals. And I think just having, we have about 100 large animals, maybe 35 or 40 donkeys and cows that live here permanently, in addition to those that are coming here for treatment. And through them, I think we've learned, and we have chickens and we have a couple of pigs and goats and sheep also. And that whole, our consciousness, our own internal consciousness has grown to want to just more urgently be educators and trainers of other people. So we're putting in quite a bit of effort trying to bring people here to help them train in first aid so that we can do more preventive medicine on the streets in India, not just in Udaipur, but I'm going to Calcutta in a week. I just came back from there. There's young people that want to start organizations. There's many throughout India who are, I must get 10 requests a day, Duncan, from mainly young people who say, how can I start an animal aid in my community? Mm. And our response is not that we need to start it. Let's start what you need. By your lights, and we'll help train you. And that's kind of our method of expanding the services to animals is not through franchising animal aid, but through helping share our skills with people so that they can build it in their own communities in the ways that are most needed and in line with the resources that they have.
So in the 16 years since you did start Animal Aid Unlimited, how many little either rescues or sanctuaries or other kinds of things do you think through your help and guidance that have been created elsewhere?
I don't know that there would be any single one that has been that I would give credit to Animal Aid Unlimited beyond being one of the inspirations. I think it would be false kind of pat on the back to take any credit beyond that. But I think that's a significant one because I think that the rescue videos, which have 300 million views on YouTube, a tremendous impact. I mean, it blows my mind how many people know about Animal Aid because of those little short happy ending rescue videos. And I'm not counting the Facebook views. I don't know how many millions there are on Facebook, but there's a lot. And I think that because our equipment is simple, you can see that the people that are involved in rescue are not technically very different from you or me. It just gives people the confidence to say, wow, I could do that. I could help that animal. And a lot of little group collectives of young people are getting that idea that why not me too? And I just think that's fantastic. And so I like to think that because of social media, there's more and more people being connected together in seeing that we're stronger if we work together than if we work independently. And now there's a federation of Indian animal protection organizations that works on legislative issues and law and networking. And I'm a very active member of that federation and one of the founding members of it. And that's brought together about 100 member organizations, many of whom have very small activities. Maybe they just take care of birds during a particular festival where there's a lot of kite flying, where birds get injured, or they just do cats, or they have a very small service geographical service area. But there's the longest march starts with a single step, and I'm so convinced that just little things add up, and that's the whole name of the game. I think is to not you can dream big, but it's fine to do small and just keep doing it, keep showing up tomorrow, and meet each other and try to buck up the spirits of one another. It's terribly lonely and sad if you're, trying to help animals and you can't even scrape together the rupees to do it and you see many more needs than you can possibly fill. You really need each other to say, keep going, be strong. I'm here with you. I'm going to try to help you. And it's just moral support and it works.
No, that's critical. And that's why I was asking about other places that might have popped up in the wake of your guidance or even just your example. I wasn't really thinking so much about that it would be self-congratulatory in any way, but in fact that with so much need clearly everywhere outside of your area but beyond, that just any guidance or help or tips or whatever that you've offered, anybody who's done anything on the most modest scale is then helping that many more animals that weren't being helped last week or the week before. So I just think that's really significant.
And I think, Duncan, that one of the things that young people don't know, and that I and Jim and I had the advantage of having been fundraisers, so we knew the importance of documenting everything you do, making it available, communicating it, asking for help. A lot of the people that are starting, and this is true in America too, people don't realize what a source of dignity it is to ask for help for those animals, and that there's nothing to be shy about. It's only to be proud to say, if if you and I share this value and we both want to help these animals, I can do this for them. What can, you know, do you want to help? Can you do this? Can you give this money? Can you give this time? And that formula of documenting what you do and communicating it and asking for the things you need help for and make it in a realistic ask. If all of us out there, and this as true in America as in India, could remember those three things, the animals would benefit tremendously, because I think there are many good-hearted people out there that simply don't have the confidence to donate money or to an unknown quantity. So you have to make your work a known quantity to them. And if they can't donate or have another priority, fair enough, but help them see what it is you do and make it easy for them to understand.
Well, that's, I think, maybe the perfect point on which to end this. We have just about reached the end of our time, but with that in mind, I want to make sure to mention that the website is animalaidunlimited.org, and probably it would be implicit now. There's Facebook, Twitter, other social media, all different ways to reach and learn about, and if you're inclined, to support Animal Aid Unlimited. So we've been speaking with Erica Abrams. Thank you so much, Erica, for all your great work and joining me today on Talking Animals. Really appreciate it.
Duncan, thank you for all you do for animals. You're a fabulous source of inspiration for many, many people. Thank you so much.
Well, that's very kind of you to say. All right, have a great day, I know, or a great evening, I guess, in your time, but thanks again.
Yeah. Bye-bye. Okay, bye for now.
In a few moments, I'll speak with Greyhound correspondent Don Goldstein about where things stand with Prop 67, the constitutional amendment that could spell the end of greyhound racing in Florida. Right now, it's time to step into the comedy corner. It's been a while since we've heard from Maria Bamford, so I thought we'd rectify that with this piece I'm calling Raccoon Horseback Riding. This is Maria Bamford in today's comedy corner. We're talking animals.
My husband has noticed that I like to tear open packages of food, take caps off beverages, and leave it out and around. And he said very kindly, very sweetly, "Why?" And I said, "Because I'm a raccoon. I need to get in there, get what's good, be on my way." "Oh, but what if it goes bad? What if you get sick?" "Were you not listening when I just mentioned that I'm a raccoon? I can digest ceiling tile. I just need to fill this up, get back to the river with my friends."
"Did you just bring an old salad to bed?"
"It's nighttime. I'm awake." "This year, my friend Amy is all trying to get me to do stuff. I'm going to try to say yes."
"Do you want to go horseback riding?"
"What is it?"
"You go on a dusty trail with two lesbians who used to be a couple, but now they run a small business together, and horses bite."
"Okay, I'll go once, and I'll need a Dairy Queen peanut butter parfait on the way back. That's hot fudge, peanuts, ice cream, hot fudge, peanuts, ice cream, hot fudge, peanuts, ice cream, cherry topper."
"You want to go swing dancing? Are people still doing that?"
"The war is over. There's plenty of pantyhose for everyone."
All right, we're cutting Maria Bamford a little short today because we've got Don Goldstein and we got to make sure we have enough time to chat with him. So that was Maria Bamford with a piece I've called Raccoon Horseback Riding, taken from one of her appearances on Conan. All right, on to the aforementioned Don Goldstein for an update on how greyhound racing in Florida could end and what we can all do to help. This is Don Goldstein back on Talking Animals. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks for joining us once again. So fill us in on what's happened in the month or so since we last spoke about this kind of whole Prop 67 process.
Okay, Prop 67 did make it through the first vote on the floor of the commission. It was a little closer than we wanted. It was 18-14, but that moved it on to the Style and Drafting Committee, where it is currently. In fact, they're meeting today. The Style and Drafting Committee then goes back and reworks and is charged with grouping the ballots, the initiatives, the revisions into groups so that you don't have 25 separate ballot items. There's already five on the ballot. That would make a total of 30, and nobody can want a ballot that long. So they're grouping them, and they did that primarily yesterday, and this morning they finalized that, or at least finalized their first cut. And in that first cut, Proposition 67, which would phase out greyhound racing in Florida, is going to stand alone and not be grouped with anything else. All that is not totally resolved yet. That was a preliminary thought by the committee. So that's where it is. And then on the 16th of April, as of right now anyway, the schedule calls for the full commission to meet again in Tallahassee, and they will consider the groupings that were made. And at that particular meeting, it'll be the week of the 16th sometime, each of those ballot measures will have to receive 22 yes votes in order to be put on the ballot.
So I guess between now and the 16th, we can still register our support with the commission for Prop 67.
Without question, and the others. There's some really important issues on before this commission. So all people need to do is, if you go to the commission's website, which is flcrc.gov, that's Florida Constitution Revision Commission, FLCRC.gov, and on there you'll see a list of all 37 commissioners, and there's also one that says admin, that you can send all 37 an email at one time, or you can go through and email each of the 37 commissioners. You can also see, if you go to the proposition itself, Proposition 67, you can see who the 18 commissioners were that voted for it. You can see the 14 commissioners that voted against it, and you can see the five commissioners that were not present when the vote was taken.
So, Don, with that in mind, I mean, what sort of message should people send in these emails, whether they do a generic blast or target certain commissioners? Because I've heard from a couple, two or three times so far now, that some people apparently at least have been sending sort of kind of angry or unpleasant emails to the commissioners, which I would not think is a particularly effective gambit.
No, it's not helpful. It really is not. We want people to be positive, to let the commissioners know how they feel. And the point they want to get across is that the people of Florida ought to decide. As commissioner Senate President Tom Lee, the sponsor of this, has said a number of times, Florida has evolved. Our idea of what is right and wrong for animals has evolved. There was a time when dogfighting was perfectly acceptable. It is not. There was a time when cockfighting was perfectly acceptable. It is not. And we feel that dog racing is in that same category. It's no longer an acceptable way to treat animals. And that the citizens of Florida ought to have the chance to decide that.
So I guess really the main thing is, between now and the 16th or thereabouts, this is that ideal window for people, even if they've already sent emails, because we've talked about this kind of thing in our past conversations, but there's nothing preventing someone from sending another one, even if they've already sent one, correct?
That's absolutely true, and yeah. The phone numbers are also on the website.
Yeah.
If you want to give a quick call, they do keep tabs on that. Believe me, they keep tabs on that.
Yeah.
And there have been several comments in the committee meetings and in the commission, actually, about this tremendous grassroots efforts that the people against racing have shown.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. So, to me, that's why I do think it's so important for us to be having these kind of conversations, you and me, to encourage people. It's like, hey, take 15 minutes on your lunch break or whenever you have some downtime or whatever, and just send out those emails, or if you like to mix it up, maybe play some phone calls. But the fact that you, and I'm talking everybody, including me, could actually help end greyhound racing in Florida, I mean, that's gigantic, and it's well worth sending some emails, making some calls, whatever your preferred mode of communication is. But it, as Don has noted, they do notice. It does make an impact. And let's get this thing done once and for all.
And this is such a tremendous opportunity. This only happens once every 20 years.
Yeah.
And you, as you and I have talked over the years, Duncan, the legislature has just too blocked on this issue. They just can't resolve it. And it never has anything to do with the dogs. You know, sometimes it's slot machines, sometimes it's horse racing, sometimes it's other gaming issues that always stop the legislature from handling this issue. This is our opportunity. Those of us that care about these wonderful dogs and the care they receive, this is our opportunity to do this. And we don't want to let this opportunity go by.
For sure. So again, if you were driving around or just didn't have a chance to note what Don said, the website is flcrc.gov, And I think you'd even just go /commissioners. But if not, you just get to that page and look for the commissioners. And all their emails and phone numbers are there. And just take the time and just write them notes saying, hey, this is Greyhound Racing's got to end. Here's why. Please do what you can to make this happen. Or, you know, whatever your note would be. And be huge if we get there.
Yep, and keep it polite, keep it professional. And that's what separates us from others. So
there you go. All right, Don. Well, once again, appreciate your help and time and expertise, and we will be checking back with you when the next step is time to discuss here as well.
Absolutely, Duncan. And as always, thank you so much for your support for this important issue.
You bet. All right, Don. Thanks again. Take care.
Bye-bye. Bye.
All right, I'm Duncan Strauss. You are listening to Talking Animals, coming up at 11 on WMNF. It's Rob Laurie on Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including in the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lalay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott, who I know is doing some of his show to honor the 50th anniversary of the assassination passing of Martin Luther King. So be sure to tune into All Souls edition of It's the Music even at 2 p.m. And as a reminder, yeah, I won't be back, but the dynamic duo of Bev Capshaw and Ronnie Elliott will be here in my stead. Don't miss them. Totally fun. Great animal songs, great music, great people. So, and I'll be back the following week on the 18th with another edition of Talking Animals. So this is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon Largo, Weeki Wachee, and Beyond. Community Conscious Radio. NPR News is next.